From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Another big week on the campaign trail. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton accused each other of bigotry. Trump also sent mixed signals on immigration, saying there's no way to deport all 11 million immigrants living in this country illegally, which sounds a lot like what his former competitor Jeb Bush used to say.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton did not have an easy week either. She had to answer more revelations about her State Department emails and Clinton Foundation donors. So it is time now for our weekly 2016 roundtable.
Here and now!
2016!
It's hard to believe there's only 10 more weeks of that.
I was just going to say, let it out. I knew that was coming. We've got Greg Moore on the line. He's former editor of the Denver Post. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
And Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM. Julie, welcome back to you.
Hey, guys.
Well, let's get straight to the tape, because it was that kind of a week. Hillary Clinton gave a speech yesterday in Nevada saying that Trump is dangerously channeling and empowering white supremacists.
A man with a long history of racial discrimination, who traffics in dark conspiracy theories drawn from the pages of supermarket tabloids and the far dark reaches of the internet, should never run our government or command our military.
And then in New Hampshire, Donald Trump said he and his supporters are not racist for wanting strong borders and strong police.
It's the oldest play in the Democratic playbook. When Democratic policies fail, they are left with only this one tired argument. You're racist, you're racist, you're racist. They keep saying it. You're racist. It's a tired, disgusting argument.
And, of course, now Trump is saying that it's Clinton who's the bigot. So, Greg, just your thoughts as you watch these last few days unfold. They have been ugly.
They've been ugly. It's been like watching a tennis match. You know, the number one search term when it comes to bigot is definition of bigot. A lot of people, you know, are sadly sort of just, you know, mired in this negativity. You know, Trump, in some ways, when asked by Anderson Cooper what bigotry is, he defined it as, you know, promoting a policy you know won't work. Well, obviously, that's not what the definition is. But, you know, I think it's unfortunate the language is being used, but it's just a nasty point in the campaign, and I fear for what's going to happen during the debates. It's going to get uglier.
Well, Julie, let me ask you. On the one hand, to me, it seems like this is a moment where both candidates are recognizing the crucial importance of minority voters in America.
Mm-hmm.
But on the
mm-hmm.
other hand, I mean, I get a sense also that in a way, both candidates are also speaking to uncomfortable white voters.
Yes, especially Donald Trump trying to lure in the sort of suburban white voters who are uncomfortable with his proposed ban on Muslims and his rhetoric on Hispanics and African Americans. But he flubbed it. You know, he flubbed it this week when he was talking about how all African Americans live in terrible neighborhoods and they're getting shot at and have bad schools. That just seemed to flop. And what he's missing is that these Clinton Foundation meetings are terrible for her. They go right to the issue that so many voters have with her, that she's untrustworthy. And he's flubbing it, because if he just focused on that, he would be in a better position. You know, this whole calling it Hillary Clinton a bigot thing is not unanticipated. It was about 6 or 8 weeks ago that Donald Trump, on a call with his surrogates, told them, whatever we're accused of, accuse them back. Put them on the defensive. That's the game plan. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. And then there's this issue of immigration. Fascinating developments this week. Trump said that he was open to a softening on mass deportations. But on CNN last night, host Anderson Cooper pressed him on that.
So if you haven't committed a crime and you've been here for 15 years and you have a family here, you have a job here, will you be deported?
We're going to see what happens once we strengthen up our border. We're going to have a strong border, as strong as any border there is anywhere in the world. We're going to have a real wall. We're going to have tremendous protection, both technological protection and everything else. And then we're going to see what happens. But there is a very good chance the answer could be yes, we're going to see what happens.
Greg, I was watching this last night, and I came away at the end of the interviewing having no idea what was going on. I mean, I was trying hard to pay attention. Greg,
yeah.
What is Trump's position on immigration?
Well, later on in that interview, what he said was that everyone, all 11 million here illegally, have to leave and then come back. You know, as someone once described it, you know, he's modifying his position in real time as the interview is happening. He's adjusting to what he hears and modifying his proposals. But, you know, he's trying to appeal to, as was said earlier, to those suburban voters who just are not comfortable with where he is on immigration. He's a bit out of step. And so he was trying to walk it back a little bit and ended up tripping over his own feet in the end and confusing almost everyone.
Well, Julie, I want to take on face value how important the issue of immigration is to a core group of Donald Trump's supporters. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Ann Coulter's going crazy over this. Sarah Palin called it wishy-washy. I mean, we can laugh, but seriously, I'm serious about this. Right. Immigration is a central importance to Trump's most passionate supporters. I mean, they do not like this wishy-washiness, to use Palin's words.
This moment is a real test of their devotion to Donald Trump, because what we've seen so far is that he can be all over the place on any issue and it doesn't matter. He can actually hold like simultaneously contradicting positions on various things and nobody cares. As we say here in Washington, nothing matters anymore. But on immigration, you're absolutely right. This is one of the issues that he rose, that he ascended on, and now he's all over the place on it. And it's a really tough one for him. It's going to test their willingness to stick with him. And also, it's preposterous for someone that 74, 75 days out from the election to be kind of on the fly making up their immigration policy. This is a very basic thing.
And Greg, the question is it going to work, right? I mean, he's polling so poorly with Latinos, for instance, and African Americans.
I can't imagine that working. You know, it's too late for a reset. That reset should have happened right after the Republican convention. Doing it at this stage of the game only reinforces what Trump himself says, that people are suspicious of politicians telling people what they want to hear just to get a vote. And now he's falling into the same trap. I don't think it's going to work. I would be even surprised if he got 8% of the African-American vote. I wonder who that 8% would be.
Well, let's move on to talking about Hillary Clinton here for a second, Julie, because she struggled this week with more news about her private emails. She was on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel show, and she laughed off concerns about more emails expected to be released soon.
Jimmy, my emails are so boring.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm embarrassed about that. They're so boring. So we've already released, I don't know, 30,000 plus. So what's a few more?
So at the end, you...
Haha, but not so funny to a lot of voters, Julie.
No, and not to a lot of journalists either. That's nice that Hillary Clinton sat down with Jimmy Kimmel. She hasn't had a press conference since December of last year. So that is particularly outrageous. Also, you know, her emails, actually, it turns out they're not that boring, nor is her calendar. And what we've seen this week is a rush to defend Hillary Clinton, to defend these meetings with big contributors to the Clinton Foundation as, oh, there's nothing there, from the very same people who were completely outraged that big contributors during the Bush administration were meeting with Cheney to craft energy policy.
And this didn't go anywhere.
Same issue.
Yeah, this didn't go anywhere this morning on MSNBC today. She was asked if she was sure there was no more damaging emails to come about the Clinton Foundation. Let's hear that.
I am sure. And I am sure because I have a very strong foundation of understanding about the foundation, not to have a play on words.
So she says she is sure. But the Trump campaign says that all this stuff about calling him a bigot is a way to actually avoid the issue of the emails. And you kind of wonder if they have a point about that, Julie.
Yeah,
they absolutely do have a point. It's a diversion. But Hillary Clinton's confidence that there's nothing else there, you know, we'll see. There's going to be so many more released.
Well, Greg.
I was just going to say, I'm not at all sure that there's nothing to see there. I think it's a really dangerous moment for her to see the report that came out from AP showing how preoccupied people in the State Department were in conversations with folks from the Clinton Foundation, trying to get contributors, meetings and things of that nature. You know, she says there's smoke but no fire. Well, generally, where there's smoke, truly, there is fire.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple of seconds that we have, you know, a couple months ago, we started talking about how this last stretch to Election Day was going to be a battle of the negatives. And I think this week really epitomizes that. And I'm wondering, how much of a factor might it be for people who are getting turned off by both Trump and Clinton? Julie?
Oh, I think most people already are deeply turned off by both Trump and Clinton. That isn't benefiting the libertarians yet, though. We'll see if they can make it onto the debate stage. But this is a tough election for both of them. Nobody let both of these candidates are terrible.
Greg,
maybe we're getting what we deserve.
Greg, you've got the final word.
Now, the only thing I would say is it's interesting when it comes to the Clinton Foundation that Donald Trump himself donated about $100,000 to the foundation. And that may be why he is not as focused on this issue as people think he should be. Watch. Stay tuned.
All right. Well, we certainly will be staying tuned. It was a fascinating week in politics. Greg Moore is former editor of the Denver Post. And Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now. I woke up this morning, and none of the news was good.
David Broja is something of an icon in Israel. The singer-songwriter has recorded more than 30 albums, several of which went platinum. Broja has also been a prominent peace activist for more than three decades. His album, East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, pulls together his music and activism. There's now a documentary of the same name about his musical collaboration between Israeli and Palestinian musicians in Jerusalem. David Broja brought his guitar to our studios when he visited in 2014. Here he is, playing his version of Jerusalem, a classic Steve Earle song. The song appears on Broja's album, which Earle also produced.
And there'll be no barricades then. There'll be no wires or walls, and we can wash all the blood from our hands and all this hatred from our souls. And I believe that on that day, all the children of Abraham will lay down the swords forever in Jerusalem.
That was terrific.
Thank you.
So, first of all, tell me, what was the inspiration for East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem?
Well, I come from Israel, and my career started in Israel and is actually based around Israel. Although I've recorded many albums outside of my Hebrew language, I've recorded a lot of albums in the United States. And I've got about three albums I did in Spain, because I grew up part of my life in Spain, so I speak fluent Spanish. And I have been working right from the start of my career, besides the music, being part of the peace movement, the pro-peace movement. And, you know, these 36 years of my life and 36 years of Israel's history and the Middle East history. And about 14 years ago, I was introduced to a Palestinian band and the band leader. The band is called Sabrin. Mm-hmm. And the guy's name is Saeed, and we became friends. There was no agenda. He comes from the Palestinian side. I come from the Israeli side. And we just struck a friendship, which resulted in me going very frequently to his studio in East Jerusalem. And about 3 years ago, it occurred to me that whenever I go up to East Jerusalem, I am the only Israeli. And 3 years ago, I started writing songs in English. So this is the first time I'm writing my own lyrics in English. And I'm thinking, this is the kind of album I want to record in East Jerusalem. And this time, I'm going to bring my Israeli musicians. And not only that, I've summoned American producer, the great Steve Earle.
Oh, yes.
Who not only did I get him, but I hardly finished requesting his participation when he said, hey, Rosa, I'm on. So I was like, I did not expect that. There's a million and one reasons why one would not go to Israel, okay? I didn't even finish my sentence, and Steve Earle was on board. And for 8 days and eight nights, we created East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem.
In the Gaza, it's the same face I see out in California. Same face in Jericho.
David Broja, I'm wondering, why was it important to you to have the title track really emphasize the divided nature of the city?
Tell you the truth, I was kind of reluctant. But when I called Wyclef Jean and I said, let's sit down and write something for my next album, which will be recorded in East Jerusalem, he said, sure, come up one night. It took a while, but I came up. So we sit around the mics and literally start singing, and he's leading it. He says, same face in the Gaza, is the same face out in Nevada, same, you know, all these things. And I think, and I'm answering him, so many places all share the same faces. And then he goes, East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. I'm thinking, all right, let's say it that way. I mean, he doesn't even know. He's never been there.
East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, Shalom.
The more we got into the album, and, you know, I wanted the Israeli musicians to face and see the Palestinian musicians that I met, the Arab musicians that I've known. And I was hoping they would all come together, which is what happened.
So many places all share the same faces. East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, Shalom. Salam.
Now, David, I want to talk about why this really matters, because you're not just any Israeli musician.
Right.
I mean, your song Yehi Tov from 1977, it basically became one of the anthems of the peace movement during the Arab-Israeli negotiations that were taking place then.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, since you're here, would you mind just singing a little bit of that?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's got maybe 37 verses by now.
How about it? Give me a couple of verses, yeah.
So this is really written as I'm watching with my friend Yonatan Geffen, Israeli poet, as President Anwar Sadat sets foot on Israeli soil. And to us, this is bigger than watching the first man land on the moon, taking the first steps on the moon. It was unbelievable, okay? Because we grow up thinking there'll never be peace. And here it starts. So he writes a poem and he gives it to me. And this is my first song I ever wrote. So, Ani mabit me'achalon. זה עושה לי די עצוב האביב חלף עבר לו מי יודע אם ישוב הליצן היה למלך הנביא נהיה ליצן ושכחתי את הדרך אבל אני עוד כאן ויהיה טוב יהיה טוב כן לפעמים אני נשבע אז הלילה הוא הלילה איתך אני נשאר. There's a verse which I conclude the song with after many additions and trials to conclude the song. This one says that we shall learn to live together under the olive trees. And the children will grow up knowing no more war, no terror, and no frontiers. And that fresh new grass will grow over the graveyards for love and peace. For after 100 years of war, we haven't and will not lose hope. And it goes like this. Od nilmad lichyot biyachad Ben chushot tatzei zeiti.
We're listening to Israeli singer-songwriter David Broja about his album East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. As we heard earlier, when he was visiting the predominantly Arab East Jerusalem, he'd find that he was the only Israeli musician there in that part of the city. So I asked Broja how that made him feel.
Well, you know, I'm primarily an entertainer. I sing love songs. I write about love. I perform about love. But there's also the private person. And the citizen of my country and the citizen of the world. And I care about things. I watch the news. I live the news. In Israel in particular, you live the politics. So it seems, for me, while I was developing my career and I had that first song, Yeh Tov, Things Will Be Better, which had a political connotation to it and came from a political inspiration, 99.9% of the time politics has no romance. But the people are driven by romance, by passion. And so I think that's where my role comes in. I remind them of the passion that and the romance behind it. And so 36 years later, I'm still not only committed, I have seen so much. So I'm still that positive guy who wrote that song then. And so when I was introduced to these musicians in East Jerusalem, it was very, very obvious to me that I'm going to strike up a relationship, a meaningful one, and stay there as long as I'm welcomed.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about some particular songs, because I want to hear a little bit of a song called Key to the Memory. It's one that was co-written with the Palestinian composer Saeed Murad, who owns the studio where you recorded this album. You sing a verse in Hebrew, and then Palestinian singer Mira Awad sings in Arabic. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Well, the Key to the Memory is really about refugees, not necessarily Palestinian refugees. It's about the people who are displaced, all these places in the world where it could be from a tsunami, it could be from war, all kinds of reasons why people have to move. But, you know, the first thing that you do is you erase the immediate past and try to move on in life. And then sometimes your memory becomes, you know, a little bit vague. And what I'm trying to say is, hold on to the key to the memory and don't forget where you're from. Always remember and always allow yourself to fall into that place, because this is you.
Our conversation with David Broja from January 2014. The documentary on the making of the album, which is also called East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, is out now on DVD. We asked David Broja to take us out on another tune, 1-2-3, a song he wrote in English.
Don't want to preach to no one tonight, just want to tell my tale.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen spoke today at a Fed annual policy conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and she said the case for a rate hike has strengthened in recent months because the job market has improved and prices are stable. Well, to take a closer look, we're joined now by Bloomberg's Mike Regan. He will help us examine what this all means. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so what case did Janet Yellen make about maybe raising rates?
Well, basically, the Fed has two primary goals. The first is to promote a strong labor market. And with the unemployment rate below 5%, that's sort of looking like mission accomplished on that front. Obviously, the other goal is to keep inflation at a level that's neither too high or too low. If it's too low, it can be a problem for the economy. And that's been the concern throughout the entire recovery from the recession, is that inflation really hasn't picked up to that sort of healthy ideal level. Now, today she signaled that she didn't really need to see it reaching their goal of around 2% in order to raise interest rates. But she said she's confident it'll get there over the next couple of years. And she emphasized that measured gradual interest rates along the way to that goal is still sort of the goal, the plan they're operating under.
Okay, so back in December, the Fed did raise short-term interest rates a quarter to a half a point, the first change since 2008. Today, did she give any indication about when the Fed might raise interest rates, and if so, by how much?
She didn't commit to a specific date, and most of the observers believe that's a pretty canny move on her part because it gives her some flexibility. But the reaction from most experts is that their September meeting is a possibility. Markets are pricing in about a 38% chance that they'll increase rates in September, and about a 62% chance that they'll do it in December. Now, those odds can jump around a lot, but for the moment, that's what it's looking like. less than a 50% chance of September and then a greater than 50% chance by December.
You know, Janet Yellen said something at the end of her speech, which I found really interesting. She said stronger productivity growth would tend to raise the average level interest rates and therefore would provide the Federal Reserve greater scope to ease monetary policy. But then she said, outside the narrow field of monetary policy, there are many possibilities to increase that growth, bettering the education system, investing more in worker training, et cetera. These are not things that the Fed can do. Is she looking to Congress and saying, look, if you really want us to take action, you have to do something to boost the economy?
I think she is. And I think that's a very common theme now among central bankers is that they're saying we can only do so much with monetary policy, with interest rates. And at some point, they really believe that the governments need to respond with some fiscal policy, whether it be infrastructure spending or education spending, something to give an extra jolt to the economy, because the monetary policy sort of has diminishing returns after a while. And, you know, they can't really do much more with it to stimulate the economy.
Right. And little hope of any action happening in Congress until after November at the earliest, I'd say.
Well,
right. Finally, Mike, just briefly, there were activists and protesters outside the symposium today. But this year, for the first time, there was a public forum for policymakers to meet with activists. What's going on with that?
Yeah, there's a group called Fed Up that showed up in Jackson Hole. And one of their goals is they're of the camp that believes that rates should stay lower for longer. And they also want more diversity in the Fed.
Yeah.
You know, the regional banks are, let's face it, mostly white male bankers. And they think there's room for some more diversity.
Well, Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The death penalty is on the decline across the country, even though a majority of Americans still support it. 20 states have banned it, and 4 others have a moratorium on executions. Last year, 50 people were sentenced to death, and that's less than half the number from 6 years ago. But in those 6 years, the majority of death sentences were handed down in just 16 counties. Emily Bazelon writes about it in this week's New York Times Magazine. And Emily, let's go through some of those counties and what it is that they have in common.
The counties include big cities like Los Angeles or Las Vegas. They also include suburban areas like Riverside, California. And then there are some rural pockets like Mobile County or Jefferson County, Alabama, or Caddo County, Louisiana. The key findings about these 16 counties and what distinguishes them are that they have aggressive prosecutors who frequently pursue the death penalty. They have criminal defender systems with some serious flaws. And so in some cases, there are defense lawyers who are just not putting up a real fight. And then the third factor in a lot of these places is a history of racism and a kind of continuing cultural legacy of racial bias and racial exclusion.
All right. To point that story out, you go to a place called Duval County. It's home to Jacksonville, Florida, and you profiled a murder case there. 3 years ago, a young man murders a manager at a cell phone store, a young woman. Tell us just a little bit more about what you found there in that story and what it tells us about the state of the death penalty here in the U.S.
This is an incredibly tragic story in which a young 20-year-old woman named Shelby Farrow was murdered by a 21-year-old man named James Rhodes. He walked into a store, asked her for the money in the cash register. She gave it to him, and he shot her in the head. And the state attorney in Duval County, who's elected, her name's Angela Corey, she decided to pursue the death penalty. The mother of Shelby Farrow, whose name is Darlene Farrow, did a lot of investigating on her own about this crime and about James Rhodes. And what she found was a trail of abuse and neglect from his life, which is fairly typical of people who commit murders like this. He had been raised in state custody, and Darlene started saying and thinking to herself that the state raised him. How can they now try to kill him, given the abuse he'd suffered growing up as a child in a state boys' home in Florida? And so Darlene decided to oppose the death penalty in this case, even though she is deeply grieving for her daughter. And she's gotten into a kind of public conflict over the death penalty with state attorney Angela Corey. And that was really interesting to me. It's unusual to see a victim's mother be such a strong advocate against the death penalty in a case like this. And it drew me into wondering about the kinds of evidence that mitigate Gates against the death penalty in James Rhodes' case, the kind I just described, and to ask why Angela Corey was so determined in this case to continue to seek the death penalty, even though the victim's family has a different conception of justice.
No, it is an issue of social justice here. You quote a law professor who studied the death penalty as saying that racism is the historical force that has most deeply marked the American death penalty. So tie that back to what the victim's mother found with the murderer's background, and to what extent that made her think that he shouldn't be sentenced to death.
Well, James Rhodes is black. Shelby Farah was white. She's also part Palestinian in her heritage. And that is typical of death penalty cases. There's a lot of research showing that when a victim is white, that the defendant is much more likely to be subject to a death sentence. And that's especially true if the defendant is black. So there's something very typical about this case. And when you look at the pattern of death penalty prosecutions in the 16 counties where death sentence remain prevalent, you often see a tilting toward a lot of sentencing of black and Hispanic defendants and a lot of attention to cases with white victims.
And you've mentioned the prosecutor in this case, Angela Corey. When she heard that the mother of the victim didn't want to have the death sentence for the murderer, she said, well, it's basically not up to the family to decide. So how much of the decision does come down to how strong the prosecutor is?
A lot of the decision, particularly about whether to seek the death penalty, is entirely in the prosecution's hands. And what you see in places like Duval County are prosecutors who charge the death penalty in cases where most other prosecutors in the country would no longer make that call. And you can see that in the case of James Rhodes. There is this strong evidence of abuse and neglect from his childhood. He also scored low on an IQ test, so it's not even clear that it's constitutional to execute this man. Those are the kinds of factors that many other prosecutors in Florida and elsewhere would take into account. And to Angela Corey, they are not dispositive. She is proceeding with the death charge despite all of that.
And you've mentioned the role of defense attorneys. What about the defense attorney in this case?
Well, there's an elected public defender in Duval County. That's the system Florida has. It's very unusual. And what it leads to is uneven performances. So there are some really good public defenders in Florida. And then there is Matt Shirk, the public defender who was elected in Duval County, who ran at the age of 35 8 years ago without ever having tried a homicide case. And he came in and fired a group of senior attorneys who had really stellar reputations for providing representation in death penalty cases and lots of other kinds of cases. So Shirk has essentially been accused of gutting that office. He and Angela Corey, the state attorney, are actually up for election on August 30th.
And because they are up for election, you know, they may make the argument that they're just representing the needs and the wishes of their constituents.
Right. And that is what elected prosecutors and, more unusually, public defenders do say. And I think this is a really interesting referendum on exactly that question in Jacksonville and Duval County right now. Is this what the voters want? They have a chance to very directly answer that question in whether they choose to continue the tenures of Angela Corey and Matt Shirk.
Well, there are a lot of excellent prosecutors out there. There are many very good judges and defense attorneys. But, you know, your piece brings up the idea that there are some echoes, perhaps, to the Black Lives Matter movement here, that this is maybe another battleground in a fight against law enforcement's discrimination against blacks. Did you see that at all?
Yes. In some of these 16 counties, one thing that's very striking is the degree to which the criminal justice system remains in the control of a white power structure, even though there's a sizable minority population. So, for example, in Alabama, which has two counties on this list of 16, every single appellate judge, all 19 of them in the state, they're all white. Most of the trial judges are white. Only 14% are not. Almost every elected prosecutor in the state is white. And so you just see this imbalance in terms of who is making the calls and who is reviewing these cases. And it really tilts against African-American defendants.
And not only that, but the jury panels are almost entirely made up of white members. Why is that?
That's because of a test the Supreme Court imposed a number of years ago. The court said that in order to sit on a death penalty case, a juror has to be what's called death qualified. And that means that if you express significant doubts about the death penalty for religious or moral reasons, you can't sit. And it turns out that African Americans tend to have more skepticism about the death penalty than other racial groups. So simply for that reason, more of them are disqualified from these cases. And then there are also prosecutors who come up with specious reasons for striking African-American jurors.
Well, as you say, the prevalence of the death penalty is going down across the country. 20 states, including the District of Columbia, have abolished it altogether. Could the argument be made that the death penalty should be overturned because just a handful of counties across the country are the one imposing it?
You know, the standard for the constitutionality of any punishment in the United States is the Eighth Amendment, and it's about whether the punishment is cruel and unusual. So if you think about this focus on unusual, the less a sentencing practice is actually being used, the more it seems like it's become rare. And the way the Supreme Court has interpreted cruel and unusual also goes to whether a punishment is arbitrary. So one argument is that if a punishment is rarely used, then it is not proving itself to be useful in terms of deterrence or in terms of retribution. And another argument that comes into play here goes back to these issues of racial disparity we've been talking about. If you can show that a black defendant who kills a white person is much more likely, controlling for lots of other factors, to be subject to death, then haven't you showed that there is a kind of racially charged random quality to who gets the death penalty that should trouble us?
Well, Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Will link you to her story. It's called Where the Death Penalty Still Lives at hereandnow.org. Emily, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Today, President Obama expanded the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in Hawaii, making it the world's largest marine protected area. The move quadruples the size of the existing marine monument to more than 580,000 square miles, nearly four times the size of the state of California. Steve Giddings is the science coordinator at NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, and he joins us now. Steve, tell us about this protected area. Where exactly is it?
The protected area itself is the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. So all the non-occupied Hawaiian Islands, which most people don't even know exist, so they extend for well over 1,000 miles up to the northwest of the main Hawaiian Islands that most people are familiar with.
And what is the importance of the area historically, culturally, environmentally?
As you can imagine, most of these islands are quite isolated, quite far from anywhere that's populated. So the ecosystems themselves up there are in quite pristine condition. So there are many, many species on these really remote places that are seen nowhere else in the world. Up to a quarter, or maybe even more than a quarter of the species that are out there are seen nowhere else. And we're talking here corals and sponges and seabirds and marine mammals and sea turtles and, you know, monk seals, some endangered species as well, are up there and depend on these habitats, these small islands and the waters surrounding them and the reefs surrounding them and the seamounts out there. They all depend on those as critical habitat for some part of their life or their entire life. So this is a really rich area with a high number of species found nowhere else in the world.
President Obama's decision to expand the Marine National Monument did receive some pushback a little earlier this year. In fact, I'd say significant pushback. I mean, we were looking at a couple of letters sent by members of the Hawaii State Legislature from both the House and Senate side there. And I've got an April 28th letter from Hawaii Senate President Ronald D. Cauchi, who basically wrote, accept this as a request not to expand the monument. And he cited a couple of reasons. One is that the fishing and seafood industry, quote, is an integral part of Hawaii's culture, identity, and economy, and that, again, this is from his letter, expansion of the monument would result in at least an 8% reduction to the longline fishing industry. And then he goes on to write, quote, nearly one-fourth of the waters surrounding the Hawaiian Islands are already designated as no-take marine protected areas, exceeding the 20% global standard for marine protected areas. The proposed expansion of the monument would increase the no-take zone to 67% of the United States' exclusive economic zone waters surrounding the Hawaii archipelago. So basically, there was some concern there that this would or will have a profound impact on other aspects of Hawaiian life, culture, and economy.
I don't know specifically about those numbers or those. They do sound right as far as the area protected versus unprotected around the Hawaiian Islands. I will say most of the activity with regard to fishing and so forth clearly takes place around the main Hawaiian Islands as opposed to the Northwest, partly because it has been closed for a good long time, more than 10 years now, around the islands themselves, which I have to say, from a scientific standpoint, really makes that place a unique location to be able to understand and study these hot spots of biodiversity and what a natural, pristine place looks like in the world at a time when there are so few of them around. If you look at the community structure out there, say the animals and plants that live there, over half the biomass is at the top of the food chain, which is unheard of almost anywhere else in the world. There are very few places that have sharks and jacks and everything else like that in such abundance. So this begins to show us what a place that is unaltered by humans might look like, you know, if we give nature the chance to take control again in some places around the world. So while it is a high percentage of protected area for the Hawaiian Islands, no question about that, if you look at around the world, we're still at a very low percentage of waters protected.
Well, let me ask you one final question then. World-renowned oceanographer Sylvia Earle wrote an opinion piece in National Geographic today calling for a national marine park system that's similar to the terrestrial National Parks Service. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you look at acreage right now, there's actually quite a bit more protected in the oceans than there is in the national park system. That doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just interesting fact. The challenge in addressing what Sylvia calls for there is, how do you do it? How do you actually control and track visitation to marine protected areas in the same way that we do for national parks, because we don't have entrance gates? And so we have to think of them quite a bit differently. But at the same time, think of them in terms of high levels of protection and tracking as best we can what the visitation levels are and what people are doing when they're there. It's quite a challenge to monitor places in the ocean the same way we might monitor them in the national park system. But she's definitely on the right track in terms of calling for us to address those challenges and protect places in the ocean as well as we do some places on land.
Well, Steve Giddings is the science coordinator at NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, talking to us about the expansion of the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in Hawaii. Thanks so much.
You're sure welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm incredibly proud of you for pronouncing the name of that place.
It's
Thank
a beautiful
God
language.
I didn't have to do it. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.